And I read this week about someone called Lance Corporal Geraint Jones. It was an interview with him. He'd been in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he was talking about what it was like for these young men pumped up on adrenaline and testosterone going out into battle. And he was talking about jumping out the back of their armored warrior vehicles as they're about to go off on patrol. And these young guys, the phrase that stuck with me is they jumped out of these vans was, "Bye-bye legs." That's what they'd shout as they jumped out, "Bye-bye legs," because of the improvised explosive devices, the bombs, the booby traps all around them. They were shouting, "Bye-bye legs." And I thought, I wonder what it must be like to go out into that kind of context, to know there is an enemy out there that is trying to kill you, that wants to see you dead, that will be pleased to see you hurt and harmed and maimed. And the thing that Esther chapter 3 and 4 says to us this morning is that if you are a Christian, you don't have to imagine that. You need to wake up to that. Because Esther 3 and 4 says there is a vicious enemy out there. There is an enemy out there that hates God's people. Now, that might sound like a bit of an extreme thing to say, but it is striking that all over the world today, Christian persecution is just a horrendous, horrendous reality. And it's, of course, it's not just Christians who face religious persecution, but it's interesting that a Foreign Office report that came out a couple of months ago estimates that something like 80% of religious persecution around the world is directed at Christians. The conclusion of that report was that it's probably right now to talk about a global genocide against Christians. 5 years ago, there was one country classed as an extreme persecutor of Christians. That was North Korea. 5 years later, there are now 11 countries on that list. There are militant groups whose stated aim is to eradicate Christians in Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Nigeria, and the Philippines. And I could go on. Just looking around the world, the hatred against Christians is remarkable. Of course, in the West, it is much less extreme. It is much less graphic and violent. But I guess I'm not alone in kind of feeling that bubbling undercurrent, that there is a growing sense in our culture of a lot of people. They wouldn't want to kill Christians in God's grace, but they would be quite happy if they would go away. If there was no longer any Bible-believing Christians would just keep their heads down and not spread their views amongst anyone else. And so into that context, we come to the book of Esther, which we started looking at last week. It's one of the last books written in the Old Testament, about 470 BC. It is set in the court of King Xerxes. Now, this is really important to realize. This is a historical book. These events really happened. And this is the map of King Xerxes' empire. He's not exactly a household name today. Somewhere in the middle of that map, it's a place called Susa. It's a citadel in the center of the empire, it is ruled from there by King Xerxes, who is a man of incredible wealth and power. When we saw his party in chapter 1, it was marked by the splendor and riches that we could barely begin to imagine. The thing that comes home in chapter 1 of Esther is that the emperor has no clothes on. He looks so impressive, but then he summons his wife and she says no. And he's humiliated in front of all his guests. So what does he do? He sacks her. She gets replaced as queen, gets deposed as queen. But then he's got to find someone else. So he runs a competition. It's a reality show that makes, I don't know, Love Island look like wholesome family viewing. It is a competition to find out which of all the most beautiful young girls in the country is best in bed. And it is won by a girl called Esther. Now, the thing we know about Esther as readers that no one else does is that she's Jewish. That's a secret. No one else knows it. But she has this dual identity. She's Esther in court, but she's called Hadassah. That's her Jewish name. She's an orphan, but she's looked after and brought up by her uncle Mordecai. So she is part of God's chosen people, descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And at the end of chapter 2, what had happened was that Mordecai had saved the king's life. And we're expecting at the start of chapter 3, something great is going to happen. And Mordecai is going to be rewarded. But have a look at chapter 3. We're on page 503, and you might want to follow along in the Bible just to make sure I'm not skipping out bits here. But chapter 3, verse 1. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. If this was a film, at that point, the music would get very chilling and very scary. Because the thing about Haman that we need to know is that he is an Agagite. That means he is descended from King Agag, or related to King Agag, of the Ammonites. I said, well, you know, what's that got to do with anything? We don't hold someone's kind of family background against them. But the Agagites, the Ammonites, also known as the Amalekites, are historic enemies of God's people. So in Exodus chapter 17, they attack the Israelites just as they're coming out of Egypt. And this poor, defenseless people are set upon by this army. And God declares at that point, from generation to generation, he will be at war against the Amalekites. So Haman is now the enemy of the Jews. His hatred against them that we're going to see is not ethnic so much as it is religious. It is hatred against God. This is a kind of trajectory you can see throughout the Bible. God divides the world into two groups of people, those who trust him and those who are opposed to him, those who hate him. And one mark that they hate him is that they hate his people. And you can see that from Cain and Abel, where Cain hates and kills his brother Abel, all the way through the Bible storyline. And now, someone who is particularly marked out as an enemy of God's people is prime minister. He is vice president. He is the number two to the king, who has shown himself already in this book to be incapable of making a decision by himself. That is a very scary place to be if you are Jewish. Because it means that God's people have a vicious enemy. I'll explain that picture in a moment. The thing to see first is what happens next. Verse 2, all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai wouldn't kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, why do you disobey the king's command? I don't think we're meant to ask, was Mordecai right to bow down or wrong to not to bow down? But the point is that day after day, verse 4, they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore, they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he told them he was a Jew. Haman is so arrogant that he has to be told. He kind of hasn't noticed that there's someone who at the back of the crowd who's refusing to bow down. And when Haman saw that Mordecai wouldn't kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In chapter 1, I think King Xerxes is presented as a kind of comic figure. There is nothing funny about his number two, Haman. Haman is about as funny as Adolf Eichmann. That's a picture of Eichmann. He was the kind of logistical brains, the genius, if we want to call him that, behind the Holocaust, the final solution, an attempt to wipe out every Jewish person in the Third Reich under the Nazis. At Eichmann's trial at Nuremberg, it was reported that he had said he would, he would leap laughing into the grave because the feeling that he had 5 million people on his conscience would be for him a source of extraordinary satisfaction. If you want to visualize Haman, think of Eichmann. This is a man who is planning a genocide. He is committed to wiping out God's people. This is not a kind of rerun of the Holocaust whatsoever. Like, it's a forerunner, a shadow of the Holocaust. And verse 7, he chooses a lucky day in the 12th month of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan. They cast the poor, that is the lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. And he goes to the king, verse 8, he said to King Xerxes, there is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all other peoples and who don't obey the king's laws. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. That's a very clever lie. Like all the best lies, it's a mixture of truth, half-truth, and outright deceitfulness. So there's a certain people Notice they're never named. It makes them sound more sinister. Dispersed and scattered among the peoples of the provinces and all the provinces of your kingdom. Makes it sound like they're some kind of fifth column, like they're planning some kind of attack. Why are they dispersed everywhere? It's because they're in exile. The king of Jerusalem's been broken. A handful have been able to go back to Jerusalem, but their power is totally destroyed. They're utterly vulnerable. That's why they're exiles. Their customs are different from those of all other people. Yes, that's true, but they don't obey the king's laws. Well, Mordecai has just saved the king's life. Haman's suggestion is, verse 9, if it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I'll put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. So the king took his signet ring from his finger, gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Notice that's his title now, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do with the people as you please. He doesn't mean that, by the way, and keep the money. Yeah, he wants the money. But do with them as you please. Haman has now got carte blanche to wipe out, full permission to wipe out the entire Jewish people in the empire, which means pretty much all the Jewish people in the world. And if we want to kind of visualize this, it is the kind of we're getting ready for Auschwitz again. Think of those pictures of women and children being taken in to the gates of Auschwitz. Verse 12, on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. They were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they'd be ready for that day. It's a very, very clever plan, isn't it? You get the sense, don't you, that there are people all over the empire just itching to lay hands on the Jews and hurt and harm them and destroy them. And if you set out a decree that says it is legal on this day to kill this person and take their property and it's yours, if you kill them, their property becomes yours, you kind of assume that the people will go for that. There'll be a significant number of people who are out to get them. The Jewish people are going to be wiped out. And one of the things we know already from the book of Esther is that the laws of the kings of the Medes and the Persians can't be repealed. Not even the king is able to turn back this law now it's gone out. One of the things that happens throughout the book is lots of parties. Verse 15, spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out. The edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink. So they're in the bar, they're having too much to drink. But the city of Susa was bewildered. Outside, everyone is just reeling at this. And I want to press pause at this point and think about what is going on here, because this is not just of historical interest. Taking the headlines from the last few weeks, this kind of hatred, irrational, deceitful, vicious hatred against Christians is happening all over the world. So this week in the headlines in Pakistan, the case of Shehzad and Sharma Masih is back in the papers because two people have just been acquitted of what happened to them. Shehzad was a laborer in a brick kiln. That's a picture of a brick kiln. They're making bricks. Temperatures in those kilns get to about 700 degrees. And he was burning some papers in there, and someone accused him of burning a copy of the Quran. It was a false accusation. So they burnt him alive with his wife, who was pregnant. 2 Sundays ago, when we were at the weekend away in Burkina Faso, militants marched into a church and shot 4 worshippers who were there. That brought the total of Christians killed in churches in that area by that group to 20 over the couple of weeks beforehand. They burnt the church to the ground. They left it. Sri Lanka, Easter Sunday. The kids at that church were in Sunday school. The teacher asked whether any of the children would be willing to die for Jesus. And all of them put their hands up, went out of Sunday school, went into the playground area outside to play. Moments later, suicide bomber detonated his bomb. 14 of the kids were killed, along with 15 adults. And we could just go on. And we could go on. And the question comes, why is this happening? See, if a suicide bomber walked in here and detonated a bomb today, and there would be people all over the world who would rejoice at that. And the Bible, it seems so just unimaginable. It seems so impossible and implausible. Why would people do that? The Bible's explanation is that behind all of that hatred is a greater enemy. The Bible talks about the devil as a real force, a real person. We've kind of got to forget the cartoon strips that we've seen. We've got to forget the way the devil's portrayed on radio and TV as someone who's just got a kind of nasty strain of humor, a kind of dry sense of humor, and just a bit cruel. There is an enemy who is out to destroy God's people. The Bible talks about the devil not as the ruler of hell, but the one who will one day be destroyed in hell, but who is committed to taking as many people as he can with him. So if you are here this morning, whether you would call yourself a Christian or not, you have a vicious enemy who is out to destroy you. And the question comes, is there anything that can be done about that? As Laura and Adrian baptized Mason earlier, we all said together to Mason, fight valiantly as a disciple of Christ against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And when we say that, we are not joking. We're saying that to be a Christian means you are enlisted in a battle. You've joined a fight, a terrible war between those who between God and those who love him and those who hate him. And the call to become a Christian is a call to change sides. And when we read a chapter like Esther 3, we've got to ask, why would I want to do that? Seems a very foolish, a very risky thing to do. I just want to much more briefly look at the start of chapter 4, where we discover God's people are utterly helpless in the face of their enemy. Chapter 4, verse 1, when Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. I've heard people say, I feel like we keep going back to the Holocaust this morning, but the parallels are extraordinary. But I have heard people say, why didn't Jewish people rise up and fight back against the Nazis? Don't you think, how on earth would they have done that? Got a couple of million half-starved men, women, and kids locked up in a ghetto in Warsaw. Who's going to fight back? How is anyone going to fight back against the might of the Persian Empire? And Mordecai does the only thing he can. He puts on sackcloth and ashes. It's the clothing of helplessness, of begging, of prayer, of desperation. And he goes to the citadel, and he can't even get into the castle. Esther has been in the citadel. She's been in the empire around the emperor too long. Verse 4, when Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress, and she sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he wouldn't accept them. Seems almost as if Esther thinks the problem is that, you know, Mordecai has suddenly developed really bad fashion sense. The answer to his problem is a new wardrobe. And then she discovers it's much more serious than that. Verse 5, then Esther summoned Hattach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Esther is in the palace. She is in the place of luxury and comfort. She is in the place of security. She can't leave. Mordecai is outside. He can't get in. He's dressed in rags. He's in the place of weeping and despair. And there is this conversation is carried on through a messenger. And it gets more and more serious. Verse 6, so Hattach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Why is Mordecai bothering Esther? Why is he going to Esther? It is because there is now only one hope for the Jewish people. And that is for someone to go to the emperor, to go to the king Xerxes, and beg him to change his mind. But how do you do that? See, how do you even get into the citadel to talk to King Xerxes? In the entire empire, there is no one on the side of the Jewish people who is able to go to the king, except for one person. One person has got that kind of access, and that is Esther. And in a sense, imagine after the 1942 Wannsee Conference, if there'd been someone who could have gone to Hitler and pleaded with him to change the policy, wouldn't you have begged them with all your heart to do that? But there is a problem. Verse 9, Hattach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. And then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death." She's saying, Mordecai, I know this, you know this. I know that you know this, you know that I know that you know this. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Esther is eye candy. She's there to look pretty. She has no power at all. She's queen and she can do nothing. She can't even approach her own husband without permission. And if anyone goes to the king without permission, well, they're going to be put to death. And Esther hasn't been summoned for the last month. Well, why would he not see his wife for a whole month? Well, presumably there is some other girl on the scene. There's a new favourite. Esther's been is out of favour. And so for Esther to go to the king is to sign her own death warrant, effectively. And you think, well, why would she do that? She is the only person in the empire, the only Jewish person in the empire who's safe because she's in the king's household. She's married to the king herself, and no one even knows she's Jewish. Look at what Mordecai says. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, verse 12, he sent back this answer. "Don't think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arrive from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this." And the point is that God's people will only survive if there is someone who can plead for them. And Mordecai is confident that they will. He's been reading his Bible. He knows the story of the promises that God has made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that God will never turn away from them. The Jewish people are not going to be wiped out. And he says to Esther, look, Esther, the only place of safety is under the protection of this God. You know, it looks like it's the most dangerous place in the world to be, to identify with this persecuted, mocked people who are about to be humiliated. They're about to be tortured. They're about to be put to death and lose everything. And the only safe place, Esther, is to stand with them. Verse 15. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. "Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I'll go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. It's incredible courage. And because I'm a horrible person, I'm going to leave the story there. And you mustn't cheat and read ahead for next week. You've got to come back and find out what happens. But the question as we close, the question that ought to leave us on the edge of our seats is, will God come to the rescue of his people? Will he come to the rescue of his people? The question, I think Scott's put a flyer on Facebook for this sermon series. It's an excellent question on it. Is God hidden or is he absent? Because one of the very striking things about the book of Esther is that God's name is never mentioned. See, the world of Susa is very similar to the world of Audley in the 21st century. There is, when God rescued his people in the Exodus in Egypt, there were signs, there were miracles, there were wonders. It was very dramatic. But in Susa, you look around and the only power you see is the power of Xerxes and Haman. You don't see God anywhere. God is invisible. And the question comes, is he absent or is he just hidden? And as we think about this story, we kind of see in history the truth of this claim that God's people have a vicious enemy. We see that in our own lives day by day. And the question comes, is there an intercessor? Is there a mediator? Is there someone who can go and plead for God's people? And as we look at the 5th century, the question is, will Esther be able to do that? Will she have the courage to do that? Will she be able to do that? She is going to risk everything. Not just her comfort, not just her royal position, not just her security and luxury. She is going to risk her life if she goes to the king. We'll find out more about that next week. The question for us in the 21st century, as we have the Bible, is we're able to see where the whole story of the Bible is going as it climaxes in the life and death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus. The question for us is, as we see this terrible enemy, the devil, ranged against us, is there anyone who can stand for us against him? Because for that to happen, you would need a royal, someone to leave their royal throne, to leave heaven, not to risk their life this time, but consciously to give it up. Think of the Lord Jesus saying, the Son of Man must be handed over. He's not going to risk his life. He's going to give up his life. And the question that leaves us with it is, will we stand with, is it safer to stand with God's persecuted people looking so vulnerable under threat of being wiped out? Or is it safer to stand against them? And that all hinges on that question of whether God is absent or whether he's just hidden. It's very bad to leave a sermon with a question, but that is exactly what I'm going to do. And we'll try and pick it up next week, God willing. Amen.